This is Alison Martin speaking to Frank Elliott at his home in Hawkhurst in Kent on the 7th of October 1997. Mr. Elliott, if we could start when you joined FIDS in 1946, what had you been doing beforehand?
I was employed by the Indian Civil Service, serving in India, and was involved in the supply of equipment for the Japanese war. At the time, or just before I joined FIDS, I was on leave in England, and I was invited through Sir James Wordy to join FIDS.
Did you know Sir James?
No, I didn't know him, but I was climbing and very friendly with Ted Pyatt. Ted Pyatt knew Sir James Wordy. In fact, I believe served on the same committee for the British Mountaineering Council with him. Sir James Wordy invited Ted and myself to consider joining FIDS. Eventually, I went up to Colonial Office for an interview and accepted the appointment.
So the appointment was based on your mountaineering experience?
Yes. At the time, apparently, they had surveyors and geologists down there, but no one really properly knowing about mountaineering techniques for crossing mountain country.
And what were your duties and roles to be then? What essentially was your role when you went down there?
I was appointed as a sort of general hand, but was base leader at Hope Bay.
And was that the first place that you went to? Hope Bay, was that the first place you went?
No. A number of us went out in the Laphonia from England to the Falkland Islands, and we were there for some weeks staying at the Monstar Hotel. And during that time, we did quite a bit of climbing in the Falklands and walking around. Then, just about that time, there was problems at Deception Island. They'd been off the air since about August, and there was some concern that something drastic may have happened to them. So when the Trepassi arrived, when the Trepassi arrived from Labrador, myself and Dick Bird were sent down to see what had happened at Deception Island, and from there we had to set up a new base at the Argentine Islands. The idea at Argentine Islands was to take over the old British Ground Land Expedition hut. However, when we got there, the hut had disappeared in the tidal wave. Sometime later, we didn't do anything, but sometime later, Sir James Wordy came down, and I rode him round in a dory looking for a new site. But we couldn't find anywhere that was better than the original site where the British Ground Land Expedition hut was. So I think it was the Fitzroy, went north and from Deception Island, brought back a lot of timber and other materials, and myself and Dick Bird and Widger Stock would collect it from Port La Croix, that was closed down at that time, started to build a hut there. And we built a hut which I believe was occupied for the next year. After that hut was completed, I moved to Hope Bay as base leader there, taking over from Vic Russell. Are you on?
Yes.
A dory is a rowing boat. I think it originates in Newfoundland. They were used up there for in the sealing industry. South on the Trepassi, which was captained by a Captain Bird, a Newfoundlander. No, sorry, Captain Burden, a Newfoundlander, and they're all Newfoundland crew, pretty tough sealers. The ship had no bilge keels, and rolled very badly. We eventually arrived at Deception Island after a pretty rough voyage, and it was quite frightening when we got there. There was no one around. The what appeared to be the remains of the old whaler's hut where they lived had gone, and in spite of blowing the ship's siren, we couldn't get any response from the shore. But eventually one man did come out, and when we went ashore eventually, we found the four of them were all quite well, although in pretty awful state, as they'd lost everything, literally everything. It was all in one hut, all their equipment, their food, their clothing, everything in one hut. And they'd lived more or less without anything for that time.
You were then posted to Hope Bay?
Sorry?
You were then sent to Hope Bay?
Yes, that's after completing the hut at Argentine Islands. I went to Hope Bay and took over from Vic Russell. He came out, excuse me, as base leader, and I went in as base leader. Our main plan for that year was to sledge from Hope Bay right down the Weddell Sea and then over the Trinity Peninsula to Marguerite Bay. Now, this journey had never been done previously. The furthest that anyone had got south, well, I think, was Nordenskjold in about 1900, and he got just past Snow Hill Island. This section that he wasn't able to pass was a pretty awful area with glaciers coming down from the mainland and onto the sea, and they'd piled up to as much as 1,000 feet above sea level. So it was quite an awful and difficult area to cross. It needed mountaineering techniques. We also had one or two mishaps with dogs in crevasses, but I was able to descend and we rescued them all without mishap. I used mountaineering techniques, abseiling down and returning, climbing up using prussic slings. This was really the only way one could get up, otherwise if people tried to pull you up, the rope just sunk into the snow and you came to a dead stop. Yes, the main purpose of that journey was survey. And we had to do geology as well, if that was possible, but in fact, Ray Ady was the geologist, and it wasn't very practical. It was necessary to keep away from the coast, about 5 or 10 miles off the coast, so Ray wasn't able to get to the rocks very often. This was a bit frustrating to him, but no doubt he made up for it later on when he went to Marguerite Bay and did nothing but geological work.
How long did the trip actually take?
Yes, it probably took about 70 days, I think, but I'm not quite sure of that. This is the journey we sledged as far as Three Slice Nunatak, and there we were met by a party from Marguerite Bay who led us over the plateau. They had marked the route over through the glaciers over to Marguerite Bay. At Marguerite Bay, we rendezvoused with the Basie party and had quite an exciting time on a mountain, 2 or 3 weeks mountaineering with the Harvard Mountaineering Club. There were two members who were on serving with the Americans and our Climbers Club members.
So this was the Finn Ronnie group?
Yeah, this was the Finn Ronnie expedition. But the two people who we climbed with were, I think one was a geologist and the other was a surveyor. We did some quite interesting peaks that had never been climbed before.
Which ones? And from there, did you then travel overland all the way back to Hope Bay?
No, I came back to Hope Bay on one of the survey ships and to start my second year there.
And what was Hope Bay like? What was the base itself like?
Well, the base was originally established by Operation Tabarin, and by the time I took over, it was completely under the snow. All those you could see were the few chimneys sticking out the top. Every day in bad weather, we had to dig out the entrance, and this was done by opening a door inwards and shoveling all the snow into the hut, then gradually making a way out and shoveling it all out again. This had to be done almost every day at Hope Bay. The life was pretty tough there, really.
And what sort of work went on there? What sort of science was going on at the time?
Well, we had the usual meteorology every 3 hours throughout the 24, with RT contact with Port Stanley to send in the reports. They were done right through the 24 hours. We were doing geology, survey. Survey was the most important thing at that time. Dr. Sladen, Bill Sladen, was doing a study of the Adelie penguin. He did a very interesting study, the life cycle of the Adelie. He was also doing some medical research work at the time as well. And also he did a photographic record of work and life at the base, which I think was destroyed in the end with the fire.
But quite a lot of science going on anyway. And did you feel when you were there that you were there for the science, or was it really a political reason to have people there?
Well, obviously it was mainly political, but in order to prove our point politically, we had to work on survey and geology and development generally.
And did you have many visitors?
No visitors at Hope Bay. It was almost impossible to get there for most of the year. In fact, when they eventually tried to rescue us, they made 9 attempts to get to us after the fire.
So you were pretty cut off. Did you have radio contact with anyone?
Yeah, we had radio contact 24 hours a day. Every 3 hours we had contact with Port Stanley for the weather reports. And we had RT contact with Marguerite Bay and the other bases.
Which is a long way away.
Hmm.
Can you tell me about your other survey trips, some of your other survey work? You're involved in surveying the southern coast of James Ross Island.
Yes. One of my parties went and did that. Brian Jefford, and two or three others went and did that area. One of the journeys they did without me.
And were they surveying all around the peninsula as well?
Were they?
Surveying all around the peninsula?
Yes, all on the Weddell Sea side. We didn't do very much on the other side because up to that time nobody had ever crossed the Trinity Peninsula. But at one stage I was asked by Colonial Office, by Cypher, to investigate a Chilean base at the Danco coast, and we then made the first crossing of the peninsula. It's quite a mountaineering feat, but we went down and located the base and delivered the usual note of protest about Crown land, and received a similar one from then about Chilean land.
But it was all very amicable.
We had quite a friendly rendezvous. We stayed there a few days with them, and then came back again overland. It's interesting, at that stage we lost a dog on the Danco coast, and we were unable to get it back again. It just disappeared. But some 3 or 4 months later, one of the dog minders at Hope Bay was feeding the dogs, and this missing dog came rubbing up against him. It had found its way right back across the Trinity Peninsula on its own, and somehow managed to find itself food. When we had any problems, either of us, we would discuss it together, or by radio, by RT. For instance, when Porson was missing from Admiralty Bay, we discussed ways and means of trying to rescue him.
Which is a long way from Hope Bay.
Yes, I was going to organise sledges and take a dinghy over there in case they got on an island and the ice had gone out, which in fact what did happen. They were all right though, they were eventually got back again. Several hundred miles, I think, south of there, we were doing a survey, and the we normally had contact from the sledge party to the base. We used to pass a weather report each day, and I would take any messages that had come through from the governor of the Falkland Islands. But quite suddenly they went off the air. We didn't think much about it because we thought it was just a question of either the radio equipment had gone wrong temporary, or a radio or a generator had gone out of action. We knew they had duplicates, so it would come in again. But this went on for about 4 days, and I decided in the end that our best plan was to dump some of our heavy equipment and return as fast as possible back to Hope Bay. Well, we made a pretty quick journey back again, doing sometimes 25 miles a day. And when we were approaching the base at Hope Bay, everything seemed to be all right. But as we got nearer, we found instead of chimneys sticking through the snow, there was just a black hole in the snow, and there was nobody there at all. But eventually, I left the other members of the party at the base, and I decided to go over to the penguin rookery to see if anyone was over there. I thought they might all be camping over there. That was Dick Byrne, Michael Green, and Bill Sladen. But when I got to the penguin rookery, I only found Sladen there, who was pretty distraught and upset, and he told me what had happened.
And what had happened?
Well, the base had burnt down, completely burnt down. And Michael Green, the geologist, and Dick Byrd, who was the base leader at Argentine the previous year, lost their lives. We don't know how it happened, but in my report to Port Stanley, I suggested it was probably because they were using petrol engines, and somehow the petrol had got on fire, and they'd been unable to contain the fire because of the very strong winds we had there. We had winds gusting up to 120 miles an hour quite often at Hope Bay. There's a funnel down the glacier, and it just built up the wind speed.
So you were left to camp out
Yes, we camped out for the rest of the time. That was no hardship. After all, we were normally camping something like 200 to 250 days a year anyway on our sledge journeys. So this was no hardship. And we had enough food because the food in the Nissen hut, we had a very old Nissen hut that was under snow, hadn't been touched. But another emergency supply of food, which was over a quarter of a mile away, burning timbers from the hut had ignited that and burnt everything down, exploded the tins. But we were all right, we had plenty of food, no problem. And we spent our time doing odd jobs around the tent, cooking, and the odd book we had to read. And we did quite a bit of mountaineering then. We ascended some of the local peaks around there, which gave everybody something to do to pass the time on. Eventually the ship, the John Biscoe, tried to get in and made, I think it was 9 attempts before it eventually reached us.
Had you been able to contact?
Yes, we had, in my second year, we had some American radio receiver transmitters hand-operated, the generator was hand-operated, which were excellent. And even with those, we were able to contact Port Stanley. We used those in my second year on the trail as well. When we were sledging, we contacted the bases and sent our weather reports in and so on, using this American equipment.
This was stuff you had to wind up?
Yeah, it was like, look, you used two hands on it and wound it. Mm-hmm. One wound and the other one did the transmitting or receiving.
Mm. So you, then at relief time, was it the Bisco arrived?
Yes, the Bisco eventually arrived and took us off.
And on that, on the Bisco, I believe Bob Moss arrived.
Yes, Bob Moss actually came out with me on the Lafonia when we first went out to Falklands. At that time, they were making the film Scott of the Antarctic, and he was on their team.
As a cameraman, or as cameraman, photographer?
Yes, he was a cameraman, yes.
And from Hobe, you then went back to Stanley?
Yes, I seem to remember I went round a few of the bases first, and then went back to Stanley. I should have returned then to England, but Sir Miles Clifford, the governor, asked me to stay on another year, and he asked me to accompany him on his round of the dependencies, all the bases, on one of the ships, which I did. We visited all the bases on South Georgia.
And what was the purpose of that? Simply to make sure things were working as they
well,
should.
Sir Miles Clifford was very, very interested in everything that went on in the Antarctic. And it was policy in the colonies for the governor to go round from time to time to inspect his installations, bases and so on. This is not only done in the Falkland dependencies, but in all the territories.
So was the governor in charge of FIDS at that point?
Oh, yes. Yes, things were a bit easier, really, in many ways. At that time, the whaling industry was very affluent. We had a very, very big revenue from the whaling industry. And this was controlled by the governor of the Falkland Islands. And all this money went into running the survey. So Colonial Office didn't have the say they had later on when it became Grand Aid. And we made our own programs, which were eventually approved by Colonial Office. I suppose Colonial Office gave us the general idea of what had to be done in the way of developing, and then we put our program of work in each year.
But basically, in those early days, it was financed by the whaling.
It was all financed by the whaling, yes.
Do you know how long that went on for?
Well, we went on for several years, that. The whaling gradually diminished. When I first went south, there was three whaling companies operating in South Georgia, and there were more people employed in South Georgia than lived on the Falkland Islands. And there was all the income tax which came in from all these men working there, and all the revenue on whale oil. So much per barrel on whale oil.
And these were Norwegians?
There was two Norwegian companies and an Argentine company. Well, obviously the policy was laid down probably by Foreign Office through Colonial Office to the governor, and he had to plan his program of work to comply with that policy.
So did he work with scientists to decide what science was going on?
No, we were the scientific side, as opposed to survey, was mostly done by the Scientific Bureau. They would advise us on that, advise Colonial Office anyway, and Colonial Office would say. But there wasn't very much priority on scientific work those days. It was mostly, we had to get a map of the place. That was the important thing.
So your main concern was survey?
Yeah. It had to be. I mean, you can't really do anything until you've got a map.
Was the Scientific Bureau was based in London?
Yes, it was. I think it was Sanctuary Buildings in London.
And Fuchs was, Sir Vivian Fuchs was?
Fuchs was eventually in charge. When he came back from Margaret Bay, he was in charge of the Bureau. He had no say at all in the administrative side of it. This was entirely the governor. And I administered, or Colonel Butler, and then myself, we administered the whole of Feds through the governor.
And this is in your position as Secretary of Feds?
Yes.
And when did you become Secretary?
Well, I eventually came back to England in 1949 and I was married. And then Ina and myself, we sailed out to the Falklands, and I took over then as Assistant Secretary of FIDS. There was some query at the time, it was either a question of me going to South Georgia as a resident magistrate there, or taking over as Assistant Secretary of FIDS. Well, we felt it was in our interest, personal interest, to be in the Falklands rather than in an isolated company, community, and we asked for the Falkland Islands. Now, my main work there was to organise the stores and equipment for the bases. Up to that time, nothing very concrete had ever been done. Originally, it was Operation Tabarin, and everything was done by the services. And then it changed over for 2 years. It was a very hit-and-miss business, the stores. The base leader made a list of what he wanted next year, but as he was going out, he wasn't very conscientious about it. And we had always the last-minute rush of running around Port Stanley, trying to find a pound of sugar or half a pound of tea, and sending to England by air for some bit of equipment that had been forgotten. So I set about organising something a little more efficient, and I produced what I called at that time standard lists. Now, these had lists of all the equipment and all the stores, everything necessary that was held on the base. And there are three columns there. Column A was the standard issue. Column B was the stock at the time of stock taking, that was the end of the year. And column C was the amount required to bring it up to column A. So column B plus column C equal column A. Now, this had formulas so that it could be varied for setting bases where they had, well, a place like Margaret Bay, they needed 2 years' supply in case the ship couldn't get in, or larger bases with more men and so on. Setting bases had sledging equipment standard lists and camping equipment standard lists, whereas the ordinary met bases didn't. Now, with the food, there was four columns. One was the man-year ration. Now, if there was five men on base, you multiplied this first column by five. And the stocks you held at the time were put in column A, the next column. If you, say, worked out, you need £1,000 of sugar, there'd be £1,000 in column A. Column B would be stock at the time, might be £400, so £600 would be the amount required to bring it up to the full quota for the year. And this was done with every single item that was required at a base. There were long lists, very comprehensive, but this had a very big advantage. We were setting up new bases at that time, quite a few, and all you had to do was take all the standard lists and order everything. You didn't have to worry about thinking about what was required. You just sent to the Crown agents the standard lists.
So did the orders come from Britain? Your orders were sent back to...
The orders all came to Falkland Islands. We made all the orders. We had a big order department. We had staff. We took over the council chambers in Government House, and that was our stores department. And we ordered everything from there. Nothing was ordered from Britain at all, except specialised scientific equipment, which we couldn't do anyway because we didn't know anything about it. The equipment, the stores and equipment, all came from London. And this was handled at that stage by the Crown agents. They became our agents. And that's how we got everything. And either myself or Ken Butler went to the Crown agents every year. And we assisted. We had FIDS office in London. And we assisted in the ordering of stores and seeing manufacturers, developments of anoraks and equipment and so on. We were involved in all that, and also on the appointments board. We were responsible for appointing, really. We had the last say in who was appointed, because we weren't always interested in a man with the highest qualifications, but whether a man was suitable for serving in Antarctica, whether he would pack up after the first month or so. And in fact, during that time that I was recruiting, we only had, I think, about one person in the whole lot that was not a success. Whereas the Australians and the French had very big throwouts, very big numbers to be thrown out.
A lot of problems.
When I was appointed originally, the Crown Agent didn't handle any of this. It was all done by just a group of people in England. I don't know quite who it was that did the ordering and so on. I say it was pretty haphazard, and we always short of materials and stores and so on. And the appointing was not done by Crown Agents. I was appointed by Colonial Office, not by Crown Agents. So everything was ordered from Port Stanley, and all the orders were submitted to the Crown Agents.
In London.
And they just went ahead and ordered everything. If there were any queries, then they got in contact with FID's office, and either myself or Ken Butler, whoever was there at the time, would investigate and advise them on what to do about it.
And what sort of... what was your relationship with the Scientific Bureau at that time?
Well, it was good. There were no problems with them, but we had very little to do with them apart from sending down, getting scientific equipment from them or ordering for them in some cases and sending it down. And they at that time also gave special instructions to scientists like geologists and so on. They brought them up to date with the background geology. And also the scientists, when they came back to England, the geologists for instance, when they'd done the year or 2 years, they went and worked up the results at the Bureau under Fuchs. I suppose there's perhaps 20 people involved with FIDS at that time. Apart from the administrative staff, there was the Met staff under Gordon Hawkins, and the Radio Sun staff under McNaughton, and some radio staff as well, very few radio, mostly done by the Falkland Islanders. But we had the odd man who used to go in and help them out sometimes.
And as SECFIDS, did you then go down around the Antarctic bases again?
Yes, I went down again, I think twice or three times. I usually, if I could, let John Green go down. He was keen to go down. He became my assistant eventually, and he used to go down. But I did go down a number of times. In fact, the last time I made the attempt to go down, we got a hole in the ship and had to return.
Which ship was that?
What was that, dear? Do you remember? What ship was it?
What came after the Visco?
No, it wasn't the Visco, I don't think. It might have been the ship. I don't know, it may have been the Bisco Shackleton, I can't remember. I've got a feeling it was the old Bisco, not the new one. Yeah, it was the old Bisco.
Kiss the dam.
No, not down there. No. Yeah, we hit something and the ship started leaking through the propeller shaft. And they quite a job to keep it pump free.
And where did you get it? Did you have to sail back to Stanley too?
Well, it went back to Stanley, but they weren't able to do it there, and it had to then go to Montevideo to the dry docks. I was in London at the time, and I went with the marine consultants from the Crown Agents to Sweden to look at it wasn't the Shackleton at the time, but to look at the ship to see if it was suitable for our needs. it wasn't completely suitable, but the marine engineers thought it would be possible to alter it, alter the holes, redesign them to give us the accommodation, which was done. It was quite an interesting ship, because it was the first time I knew anything about variable pitch propeller.
Which is what?
Well, this is the blades of the propeller can be put either to bring the ship forward or to take it backwards or to just go round without feathered, so that they didn't move the ship at all. And this was quite useful in many things. If you got into ice, you could feather the propeller and it would go around and chop up the ice.
So it was quite useful?
Quite useful, and you could maneuver the ship from the crow's nest. All the controls were up at the crow's nest, and you could work the ship from there, and when you're in the crow's nest, you could see right over the prow of the ship, see what was approaching, the web ice flows and growls and so on. And quickly you could bring the propeller around the other way, and it would come into reverse quickly without reversing the engines or anything.
So what had the ship been used for before?
It was used for the Greenland, I think it was iron ore trade, so it had quite big holes, but not much accommodation in the way of crew. That's why we had to have extra accommodation put on it.
And was any science done from the Shackleton?
Oh yes, quite a lot of science, yes. I can't remember quite well, but they did quite a bit of sounding and that sort of thing. Interesting, the captain who took over first of all, he didn't like this. He was an old-fashioned captain. He didn't like this variable pitch propeller at all and didn't use it very much. But then we got Norman Brown, who was originally the first mate, and he took over, and he was very go-ahead, and he made extremely good use of it. One of the ships, of course, got on fire at Margaret Bay.
What was that?
I think it was the Trapassi got on fire and was quite badly damaged. In fact, the whole of the deck house was loose.
Loose?
And in
danger of dropping off?
If we'd gone to sea with it like that, it would have just shot off into the sea. Well, we had a very good first officer on the ship. He was a Newfoundlander. He took cables right under the ship and fastened the deck house on. And we eventually sailed to Deception Island, and they got timbers from there and managed to make a temporary repair, and eventually went up to Port Stanley and Montevideo again for a sort of refit on the dry docks.
So the ship was actually strapped together?
Yes, tied together with cables. And the Fitzroy was down in Margaret Bay at the same time, and she came alongside to use their hoses on it to try and put the fire out, but all the pumps froze up, so she couldn't pump water on it. And eventually this chap Stone, he organised a relay of buckets of water, seawater, and passed them from hand to hand, and managed to get the fire out under control.
Because the Trapassi was a wooden ship?
Yes. The wooden ship sheathed with Greenheart. Sheathed with Greenheart.
Sorry, I don't understand.
Well, Greenheart is a very hard timber, which it hardens by abrasion. So the more you rub on ice, the harder it gets. And all the old whalers and sealers, and in fact, I think the Discovery as well, were sheathed in Greenheart.
So they were stronger?
Very strong. Britain claimed the whole of the Antarctica, the huge sector that includes South Georgia, South Shetlands, South Orkneys, and the Graham Land Peninsula right down to the pole, a huge wedge-shaped sector. But overlapping this sector, the Chileans had a big area which they claimed, and the Argentines more or less claimed the whole lot. And both these nations set up bases in different parts of Antarctica. We, from time to time, protests were delivered, mostly by the captains of the ships, our ships, to these bases. But from what I saw of the Argentinian Chileans, they literally did nothing at all, apart from perhaps the odd Met report. But that's all they did. They didn't do any development in the way of survey or geology or anything. One thing might be interesting. I was sent down eventually, I don't know quite what stage it was, to re-establish Hope Bay. Now the reason we had to re-establish it was because the Argentines had established a base there. Now we got down there with a new base hut, all the equipment and everything. We loaded one load in the scow and started across the shore, and we were fired upon by the Argentines. And Dr. Marsh and myself, Dr. Marsh was going to be the base leader and I was Secretary Fids, became the first people in Antarctica to be under fire. And that's in history today. I'll get that book out in a minute. No, the dealings I had with them were quite friendly. They were most helpful. For instance, I needed a little attention to one of my teeth when I was south, and they flew me by helicopter from the base to the Burton Island, the icebreaker, and attended to the tooth and brought me back again. And we had good relations with the climbing people of the expedition. Ken Butler, of course, had a lot of problems originally.
With the Americans?
With the Americans. Then, because the hut, the American hut, which had been there for some years.
Sorry, where?
At Stonington Island. There was an American hut there. Mm-hmm. And that had been there for some years, and it had been locked up, and all the stores covered in weatherproof sheets and so on. But it had all been ransacked and opened up. And they said the British had done it originally, but I think it was proved later the Chileans had been there.
And you finally left the survey in 1958?
Yes.
Was that why? Had you had enough by then?
Not really, no. The main reason was that we had then a daughter. She was 7 years old, and we didn't particularly want her to go to boarding school in England, as we were away from home all the time abroad. So we asked for a transfer from the Falkland Islands, because obviously at seven she'd got to the more or less the end of the schooling in the Falkland Islands. It wasn't particularly good there at that time. And I was offered several territories, and eventually I accepted Swaziland, which had a good English medium school, and it was quite a healthy territory, and one of the last territories that got independence in Africa, in fact. It was a very interesting country.
So you went out as what?
I went out originally to reorganize the secretariat, bring up the filing system and other things. And when that was done, they brought a regular manager out from England, an Englishman, and I took over as Registrar General, because there was a big development plan there, and we were registering companies and patents, trademarks and births, marriages and deaths, and reviewing the laws and so on. I took over doing all that, and I remained as Registrar General for Swaziland until I retired.
Now, on leaving FIDS, the following January, you were awarded the MBE.
Yes.
What was that in recognition of?
Well, my work generally with FIDS, first of all as Assistant Secretary FIDS, and then as Secretary FIDS. When eventually Colonel Butler left, he went to South Georgia as the magistrate there. You probably know that, do you? No. And he had a housekeeper there. He wasn't married or divorced, I'm not quite sure which, but he had a housekeeper, and eventually he married the housekeeper. And he eventually left government service and took on as vice president of the Argentine Whaling Company. And we saw him once or twice after that in Montevideo, I think it was. And then I lost touch with him. Whether he's still alive, I just don't know. He was quite a character, Ken Butler. He did a very fine journey before Fuchs. When I arrived at Margaret Bay after sledging down, he was away on a long journey. He'd sledged over to Three Slice Nunatak and then right down the Weddell Sea. He'd done 500 or 600 miles with the Americans, using some American equipment, mostly our equipment, our tents and dogs and so on. The American equipment and dogs were no good at all. And he had American aircraft support on this journey. And when he came back again, I talked to him quite a lot. And he had in mind that he would go to the pole using that method with sledging and aircraft support. But eventually Fuchs decided to do it another way, and Fuchs took over. Ken Butler rather pushed out, I think.
This is the Transantarctic. What became the Transantarctic?
So eventually the International Transantarctic did it with that method. They used just lightweight sledges and dogs and aircraft support all the way across. They did it right across from, right from Graham Land, right across to the McMurdo Sound.
And what of the dogs?
Yes, we had a lot of dogs at Hope Bay. We had over 200. And we did supply dogs to the French expedition. André Lyotard came down and we gave them a lot of dogs. We also supplied some dogs to the Australian expedition. Now, our dogs were rather different to Marguerite Bay. Most of the Marguerite Bay dogs were obtained from Greenland, and they were a long-haired dog. Now, we found in practice these weren't very satisfactory because the accumulation of ice on the dog's fur sometimes even pulled their fur off the backs. But our dogs mostly came from the Northwest Mountains in Newfoundland. They were a short-haired dog, and they were much larger. They weighed up to 120, 130 pounds. But they stood up to very cold temperatures. I sledged right through the winter. We were quite new, this winter sledging. We sledged right through the winter, and we had sometimes 80 degrees of frost. But the dogs didn't seem to bother very much, even under those temperatures.
Why did Hope Bay have so many?
Well, we were a sort of breeding base. We had a dog breeder there and did very well with him. A chap called Dick Wallin, who looked after the breeding, and we did very well. But we needed quite a lot. Don't forget we were out in the field all the time, right through the winter.
So how many in a team?
Well, we had up to 11 in a team. Now, things were a little bit different at Marguerite Bay. When Marguerite Bay started, Commander Bingham, Sergeant Commander Bingham, was the base leader. And he had his sledging experience up in Greenland. And he used Greenland dogs. And that's probably why he went up to Greenland to get these dogs. And they used a Fan Trace. Now, we used the Tandem Trace, which was the one the Northwest Mounties used. And we found these very much better because with the Fan Trace, you've got to have someone in front. In fact, Marguerite Bay did. They had someone in front all the time for the dogs to follow. But we were able to control the dogs by word of mouth completely. Eventually, when Ken Butler took over, he took over the Tandem Trace as well. He started using Tandem Trace. They dropped the Greenland method. Yeah. See, the Greenland method was fine for up in Greenland. They were hunting seal on the sea ice. And it was necessary to spread the dogs out to stop the load being in all one place. And because the ice was quite thin very often, they had to dig a hole through the ice to fish. So it's quite thin. So they use this Fan Trace because it's to their advantage not to get dogs through the ice. But the Northwest Mounties, they use the Tandem because they could wend the way between trees with a Tandem. You didn't get one dog lashed up around the tree.
And do you think the having dogs on base was a great benefit to everyone there? Or?
Oh, yes. I think almost without exception, everybody thought a lot about the dogs. We all really admired the dogs. In fact, there's a poem in that book of Porson's there about Yap, who was my leader, one of my dogs. I had quite a lot of teams, and each man at the base had a team. And my aim as a base leader was to get everybody out sledging. And I achieved this. Everybody had over 200 days sledging, I think it was, or over 200 miles sledging each year.
And for people, when they first came down, it was simply a matter of having to learn the ropes?
Yes, I mean, I didn't know anything about sledging. But I was quite lucky going to Hope Bay in many ways, because there was a man there, Captain Taylor, who I met recently at Hattersley Smith's. He's dead now, though. He'd served with Northwest Mounties and were used to dogs. And he introduced their methods of sledging. So I was able to take over a technique that was proved over the years. And we've gradually improved our camping techniques. John Francis Severe, he'd already had a year down there when I got there, and he knew quite a bit about it, and I added a bit more to it with my mountaineering camping experience in ice conditions.
Do you know where the use of pyramid tents came from? Why were pyramid-shaped tents used?
Well, I don't know who designed them originally, but they're a very wonderful tent. They're a bit, in many ways, like the mountaineering tents. They had an inner and an outer tent with four poles, one in each corner, the poles between the two, inner and outer. And the inner tent had a flap going inside the tent all the way around. And the outer tent had a flap on the outside going all the way around on the outside. Well, you're able to pile snow all the way around on the outside flap, and also your sledge boxes, things like dog pemmican, which weighed 40 pounds, pile those all the way around. And they would keep the tent down in the most vicious gales, when we had gales of over 130 recorded wind speeds. And they stood up to that.
Mm. Can I take you back to the work you did, the survey you did down the East Coast and then across to Stonington?
Mm.
Was that were you laying ground survey ground controls for the American surveys?
No, it was all ground control. It was all done by for distance by sledge wheel. And by direct reckoning, we made an astro fix every 50 miles when it was possible, and corrected our traverse, and generally kept some 5 to 10 miles from the coast. And on each point, obvious point, we'd try to get three bearings, both horizontal and vertical. We used the Indian clinometer for the vertical ones, and either theodolite or compass for the horizontal ones.
How did you feel when you were out there, absolutely miles from where anyone had ever
Well, being younger and being used to mountains and open spaces, I'd also travelled in the Himalayas quite a bit, it just seemed normal to me, nothing in it. So it was just a holiday as far as I was concerned.
What a wonderful holiday. Mm. So you weren't involved with laying ground control for the Finn Ronnie, the Rarey air photographs?
No, I don't think they did very much of that, the Finn Ronnie, anyway. See, it was all done later on by Hunting's air survey. Incidentally, the man who was flying, Lewis, just died recently. Mm-hmm. With Sir Mark Clifford. He was a grand person to work for. He's dead now. Hattersley Smith and myself went to a funeral. But he was most helpful to me in gave all the backing necessary.